21. The Eighth Disinformation Operation, Continuing Euro-Communist Contacts with the Soviets, the New Interpretation of Euro-Communism. In the MID 1970s, a display of polemics between the CDSU on the one hand and the French, Italian, Spanish, and to a lesser extent, the British Communist parties on the other seemed to indicate the emergence of a new brand of communism in Western Europe whose salient characteristic was independence of the Soviet Union. The new tendency came to be known as Eurocommunism. The idea that Eurocommunism is a tactical and deceptive device adopted by the major West European Communist parties to improve their electoral fortunes has already found expression in the West, notably in the paper The Soviet Union and Eurocommunism, by the distinguished British scholar Professor Leonard Shapiro. 1. Shapiro's paper also argues that, since Eurocommunism helps West European Communist parties electorally, it serves the long-term interests of the Soviet Union. By drawing attention to this fact, the paper makes a valuable contribution. Nevertheless, since it is based on the old methodology, it accepts the differences between the CPSU and the Eurocommunist parties as genuine and continues to see the CPSU as striving vainly to reassert its hegemony over the European parties concerned. Analysis of Eurocommunism in the light of the new methodology strongly suggests that this is not so, that the phenomenon represents a further extension of the strategic disinformation program from bloc to non-bloc parties and follows a pattern similar to earlier operations emphasizing the national independence of certain bloc parties. If so, several non-bloc communist party leaders have been made full partners in a disinformation operation in support of long-range communist policy and international strategy. The new analysis of Eurocommunism, unlike the old, illuminates the role that Eurocommunism may be expected to play in the final phase of the policy in the 1980s when democratization, on the pattern of Czechoslovakia in 1968, is likely to be introduced on a broader scale in Eastern Europe. The manifestations of Eurocommunism. The principal manifestations of Eurocommunism are set out in some detail in Shapiro's paper. The characteristic tendencies exhibited by Eurocommunist parties may be summarized as follows: a desire to demonstrate their emancipation from Soviet domination, a critical approach towards certain Soviet repressive policies, in particular violations of human rights and harassment of dissidents in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, rejection of the view that proletarian internationalism means that the state interests of the Soviet Union have priority over the interests of the international revolutionary communist movement, assertion of the right of communist parties to follow their own revolutionary policies even when they run counter to the Soviet Union's pursuit of détente and economic links with the United States and Western Europe, rejection of the view attributed to the CPSU that unity between communists and socialists is only possible if socialists renounce their adherence to class collaboration, that is, for practical purposes, if they become communists, refusal to accede to alleged Soviet demands that they should denounce the Chinese, suggestions that an electoral victory by a communist party in Western Europe would be contrary to Soviet interests, the abandonment of the quest for dictatorship of the proletariat, the apparent evolution of Eurocommunist parties into responsible national parties that, in contrast with the CPSU, accept existing parliamentary institutions and embrace humanistic and democratic principles, including the preservation of bourgeois freedoms within a pluralist society, condemnation of the use of terrorism by the radical left, absence of the leaders of Eurocommunist parties from, or their non-participation in, international gatherings organized by the CPSU, restrictions on the participation of Soviet representatives at Eurocommunist gatherings, rejection of existing military blocs and espousal of the concept of a neutral, socialist Europe, the development of links with the Yugoslav and Romanian parties, the formation within some of the Eurocommunist parties of orthodox splinter groups loyal to Moscow. Since there has been some variation in the manner and extent to which these general characteristics have been exhibited by the parties concerned, some of the main points made by each of them individually must be briefly mentioned. The French Party. In May 1975, the party produced, in a Declaration of Freedoms, a disguised attack on Soviet restrictions on civil liberties. On September 4, 1975, Lumenide insisted that the party was committed to Western-style democracy. The following January, the French communist leader Marché said that his party's divergences with the CPSU over socialist democracy were so deep that he could not meet Brezhnev. He did not attend the CPSU Congress in the following month, although his party was represented. Kirilenko, who attended the French Party Congress shortly afterward representing the CPSU, was denied the customary right to speak. In April 1976, the leading French communist Canapa criticized the Soviet Union for praising President Giscard's policy at a time when the French party was fighting it. In May, when asked what he would do about French nuclear missile submarines, Marchais refused to comment. For the previous 22 years, his party had continuously condemned the concept of nuclear deterrence. In January 1977, the Soviet periodical Novoye Vremya launched an attack on Jean Eliensteyn, the deputy director of the party's research center. Eliensteyn, who had previously written an anti-Stalinist history of the Soviet Union, published a new book, Le PC, in Paris in 1976, in which he said that there had been no liberty in the Soviet Union after 1922. He regretted that his own party had not followed the Yugoslav example and had been slow in criticizing the lack of freedom in the Soviet Union. Marchais did not attend the 60th anniversary celebrations in Moscow in November 1977, but sent a representative, the Italian party. In March 1975, Berlinguer criticized the pro-Moscow Portuguese Communist Party for its undemocratic line at the time of the abortive right-wing counter-coup in March 1975. In August, in reply to an article by Konstantin Zaradov, the editor of the World Marxist Review, implying criticism of the Italian party for seeking political alliances rather than insurrection, Lunita said that the modern Italian situation called for an interweaving of democracy, socialism, and liberty. In February 1976, Berlinguer said he wanted to see a socialist society that guaranteed individual as well as collective rights. He also said that his party was committed to Italy's existing international alliance. For months later, he said more specifically that Italy should stay in the Atlantic Alliance, which guaranteed socialism and liberty, socialism of a pluralist sort. The Spanish Party. In February 1976, the Spanish communist leader Carrillo absented himself from the 25th CPSU Congress. In the following January, the Spanish party weekly Mundo Obrero attacked East European governments for their repression of dissidents. In April 1977, Carrillo published a book, Eurocomunismo y Estado, in which he maintained that, after 60 years of existence, the Soviet Union was still not a workers' democracy. He advocated a pluralist society with bourgeois freedoms and a neutral, socialist Europe independent of either of the two military blocs. He's also on record as saying that United States bases would have to remain in Spain as long as Soviet troops remained in Eastern Europe. The book was anathematized in Novoye Vremya in June and July 1977. In response, Dolores Ibarruri, La Pasionaria, the veteran Spanish communist who, together with seven other communist leaders, had recently returned from many years of exile in the Soviet Union, proposed a resolution rejecting Soviet criticisms of the party. It was unanimously approved at an enlarged plenum of the party's Central Committee. The resolution supported Eurocommunism as the only way forward in the advanced countries. Carrillo attended the 60th anniversary celebrations in Moscow in November 1977, but was not invited to speak. He complained about this to Western correspondents. In April 1978, the Spanish party dropped the term Leninist from its title and incurred criticism in Pravda for so doing. The British party. In March 1976, the British communist leader MacLennan told the 25th CPSU Congress that his party was working for a type of socialism, which would guarantee personal freedom, plurality of parties, independence of trade unions, religious freedom, freedom of research and of cultural, artistic, and scientific activities. In an article in the Morning Star in the following July, MacLennan aligned himself with the Eurocommunist parties to the extent of denying that there was any single leading communist party and stating that each party should work out its own policy in its own country. No one else could do this for them. In November, the revised British Road to Socialism was adopted as the party program. It advocated close cooperation between the communist and labor parties. In 1976, a group of hardline opponents of Eurocommunism, under Sid French, broke away from the party to form the new Communist Party. Joint statements. To some extent, Eurocommunist ideas were developed by the Eurocommunist parties in open coordination with one another. For example, in November 1975, the French and Italian parties issued a joint statement after meetings in Rome supporting bourgeois liberties, the plurality of political parties, the right to existence and activity of opposition parties, and alternation between the majority and minority. Joint statements were made later by the Italian and Spanish, and by the Spanish and French parties that dropped the commitment to the dictatorship of the proletariat from their programs. The French party found it necessary to issue this statement despite the fact that it had not used the term since 1966. In March 1977, Marche, Berlinguer, and Carrillo held a Eurocommunist summit in Madrid that endorsed Soviet foreign policy objectives but pledged the participants domestically to work within the framework of political and social forces and to respect, guarantee, and develop all individual and collective freedoms. The Soviet attitude. Between 1974 and 1977, various articles by Ponomarev, head of the International Department of the CPSU, Zagladin, his deputy, Zaradov, the editor of the World Marxist Review, and others contained veiled and open criticism of modern compromisers and bourgeois ideologists, meaning in fact Eurocommunists. Point to an article in the CPSU Oregon Partisanes is number 4, 1974. Described in Shapiro's paper as probably the first direct Soviet attack on a West European Communist Party, criticized the leading Spanish communist ideologist Azcurate for alleging that there was a contradiction between the state interests of the socialist countries and the interests of the revolutionary movement. He was further denounced for alleging that peaceful coexistence helps to perpetuate the status quo, for refusing to recognize that it serves better than Cold War to create favorable conditions for revolution, for criticizing the Soviet Union, for opposing the projected International Communist Conference on the grounds that it might lead to the setting up of a new organizational center, and for stressing the independence of individual communist parties rather than the overriding importance of proletarian internationalism. On January 26, 1977, TASS dismissed Eliensten's criticisms of violations of human rights in the Soviet Union as anti-communist propaganda. The Eurocommunist concept of a neutral, socialist Europe was implicitly rejected in the Soviet journal Novoye Vremya. The Soviets insisted in 1975 and 1976 that communist parties should characterize NATO as aggressive and the Warsaw Pact as defensive. The Yugoslavs and Romanians. To some extent, the Yugoslavs and Romanians identified themselves with the Eurocommunists. For example, it is alleged that in the course of discussions in 1974 and 1975 on the convening of an international communist conference, the Yugoslavs, followed by a number of West European communist parties, raised a number of questions about proletarian internationalism. In the same period, Romania openly defended the right of communist parties to independence. In 1975, both Yugoslavia and Romania backed the concept of a neutral, socialist Europe, opposed military blocs in general, and refused to characterize NATO as aggressive and the Warsaw Pact as defensive. The Romanian and Spanish parties in particular enjoyed close relations. The new analysis. There are various similarities between Eurocommunism and the disinformation operations already described, which support the conclusion that it is a logical extension of the disinformation program intended to meet the requirements of communist strategy for Europe. These similarities can be seen in the manner in which the alleged differences between the Soviet and Eurocommunist parties became known to the West, in the fact that these differences are based on the artificial revival of issues settled between the communist leaders in 1957-60 and are inconsistent with the evidence of the adoption of a long-range communist policy and strategy, in the exploitation of these issues to project a false image of the evolution of the Eurocommunist parties into independent national parties with a view to promoting the success of their tactics, namely, forming united fronts with socialist and other parties. In the numerous inconsistencies in the arguments and polemics used by Eurocommunist leaders in different contexts, and in the contrast between their words and their deeds, especially in their continuing contacts with Soviet and other bloc leaders, which are evidence not of disputes, but of collaboration in a joint strategy. The emergence of Eurocommunism. The evolution of the Eurocommunist parties toward independence followed the adoption of the long-range policy. The Eurocommunist parties were among the 81 parties that signed the Manifesto of November 1960. When the Sino-Soviet split developed publicly in 1963, these parties, while avoiding condemnation of the Chinese, aligned themselves informally with Moscow, thereby identifying themselves with the moderate brand of Soviet communism rather than the militant, doctrinaire Chinese brand. In so doing, they boosted the moderate image they needed to play their part in overall communist strategy for Europe, which entailed the pursuit of united fronts with socialist parties. In 1965 and 1967, the Eurocommunist parties attended international communist conferences at Prague and Karlovy Vary in Czechoslovakia. In 1968, in contrast with their supine behavior over the Soviet intervention in Hungary in 1956, they publicly expressed their disapproval of the Warsaw Pact intervention in Czechoslovakia, thereby demonstrating their independence of the Soviet Union. In the light of their attendance at the Prague and Karlovy Vary conferences, it is likely that the Eurocommunist Party's alignment with the Dubček regime was planned and agreed to in advance as part of communist strategy for Western Europe. Allegedly, the disagreements between the Soviet and Eurocommunist parties were discussed at the World Conference of Communist Parties in 1969. It was at this conference that there was the first clear indication that the CPSU could no longer assert its traditional hegemony over the world communist movement. 3. As in the case of the alleged differences between communist parties of the Bloc, this indication, and others which followed it up to 1973, came from veiled or oblique mutual criticism in the party newspapers or from retrospective revelations by communists about debates between parties carried on behind closed doors. Early in 1974 came the direct CPSU attack on Askerit, followed by open polemics in the press of the CPSU, in the Eurocommunist parties, and retrospective evidence of disagreements at international communist gatherings in Warsaw in 1974 and Budapest in 1975, and to a lesser extent in Tihany, Hungary, in 1976. Finally, at the meeting of European Communist Parties in East Berlin in June 1976, the full measure of the conflict between the CPSU and the Eurocommunist parties was brought into the open. For the validity of the earlier evidence of disagreements was confirmed. As in the previous disinformation operations, the original evidence and the confirmation of disagreements came from communist sources. The revival of dead issues. Among the issues that allegedly divided the Eurocommunist parties from the CPSU were the continued attempts by the Soviets to dominate other communist parties, to insist that they should faithfully copy the Soviet example, and to demand that, in the name of international proletarian solidarity, priorities should be given by all communist parties to defending the interests of the Soviet Union. These issues were in fact settled in 1957, largely on Soviet initiative. Stalinist attempts to dominate other parties were rejected and condemned. Relations between parties, inside and outside the Bloc, were re-established on a Leninist basis of equality, trust, cooperation, and joint participation in the effort to achieve communist objectives. The Eurocommunist parties attended the international meetings between 1957 and 1960 at which these issues were thrashed out and settled. All of them, by signing the 81-party manifesto, committed themselves to the long-range policy and strategy that had been worked out with their active help. Against this background, it is easy to see that the revival by the Eurocommunists in the 1970s of the dead issue of the Stalinist concept of relations between communist parties was artificial, calculated, contrived, and agreed with the Soviets for the purposes of strategic disinformation in the same way as other dead issues were revived in other disinformation operations. Exploitation of the independent image of Eurocommunist parties. The revival of dead issues helped to promote the idea that the Eurocommunist parties were independent of the CPSU. The same purpose was served by suggesting that there were disagreements with the Soviet Union over the pursuit of united front tactics, especially by the Italian party, and that there was a conflict between the interests of Soviet diplomacy in improving relations with European governments and the interests of communist parties in acquiring power by legal means. Both suggestions were false, but both helped to emphasize Eurocommunist independence of the Soviet Union. United Front tactics were among the variety of tactics approved by the 81-Party Congress of November 1960. In his report of January 6, 1961, Khrushchev called on the communist parties to synchronize their watches. 3 months later, Suslov, a major communist strategist, led the Soviet delegation to the 6th Italian Party Congress. There he urged the adoption of a moderate policy to achieve a broad, national democratic front. There was, of course, nothing new or unorthodox about United Front tactics. They were specifically approved by the Comintern as long ago as 1935. Equally, there was and is no conflict between Soviet détente diplomacy and Communist Party activity. Friendly relations between the Soviet and Western governments favor the growth of Western Communist parties. Détente diplomacy and United Front tactics are complementary elements in a single Communist strategy. Détente creates favorable conditions for the formation of United Fronts. Ponomarev, head of the CPSU's International Department, made the point clearly in 1974 when he wrote that détente had the effect of neutralizing anti-communism within the social democratic parties, of undermining the militaristic preparations of the imperialist powers, and of strengthening the realistically minded elements within the bourgeois camp. 5. The harassment of dissidents in the Soviet Union and the denunciations of it by Eurocommunists are both calculated tactics. The conspicuous harassment of dissidents has its own strategic purpose, discussed elsewhere. Criticism of it by the Eurocommunists helps them to establish their credentials as genuine converts to democratic principles. The inconsistencies in Eurocommunism. There are numerous contradictions and inconsistencies in the statements and actions of Eurocommunist leaders. As observers like Shapiro have pointed out, the alleged conversion of Eurocommunists to democratic principles is inconsistent with the revolutionary programs they continue to advocate and the means by which they seek to implement them. Shapiro's paper quotes some telling statements by Eurocommunists on the use of force. For example, the Spanish delegate at the Tihany Conference in May 1976, when asked whether the Spanish working class would have to resort to revolutionary violence, said that abolishing a regime even by democratic means implies the use of force. Carrillo wrote in his book, the new ideas also mean that the party is not an army, although it is able to become one if historical conditions, the violence of the ruling classes, leave no alternative. In addition, he mentioned that party control over the communications media is an essential requirement, which gives some idea of the kind of democracy he had in mind. Shapiro's paper also quotes a report in the London Daily Telegraph of January 26, 1976, that Spanish communists had been trained in the Soviet Union and were being trained in Romania in the techniques of urban guerrilla warfare. Even in Britain, the party's aim of a revolutionary transition to socialism is to be achieved by a combination of a legislative program with mass extra-parliamentary struggles. In the use of force against anyone in the right wing who attempts a coup d'etat, the theme can perhaps be developed further in the case of Italy with the suggestion that the denunciation by the Italian party of the violence of the radical left is yet another deceptive tactic. In a paper titled Terrorism, International Dimensions, by Paul Wilkinson, attention is drawn to the Soviet interest in direct or indirect support of terrorist movements. 6. There is a strong possibility that terrorism in Italy is backed and supported by international communism in parallel and in coordination with the use of legal, electoral, and parliamentary tactics by the Italian Communist Party. The object of violence is to create chaos and anarchy, to impose additional strains on ruling democratic parties, to eliminate their ablest leaders, to force them to resort to undemocratic measures, and to demonstrate to the public their inability to maintain law and order, leaving the field open to the legal Communist Party to present itself as the only effective alternative force. Doctrinal justification for the use of terrorism is to be found in left-wing communism, an infantile disorder, in which Lenin wrote, all these fields of social life are filled with inflammable material and offer many excuses for starting conflicts and crises, for aggravating the class struggle. We do not and cannot know which spark out of the mass of sparks which are presently being strewn in every country under the influence of the worldwide economic and political crisis will prove to be capable of setting the fire alight, in the sense of rousing the masses, and we are obliged therefore with our communist principles to set about working over every possible, even the oldest, and apparently most hopeless field of action, since we otherwise will not be equal to the task, will not be thorough, will not possess every type of weapon. More specific was Shelepin's instruction to the Soviet intelligence service in 1959 to the effect that the service and its illegals should prepare and carry out operations that would destabilize the main Western countries and create chaos, which could be exploited by the local communist parties to their advantage. Shapiro's paper rightly concludes that no rupture between Moscow and a Eurocommunist party has taken place and none is likely. Despite the polemics, the Eurocommunist parties have continued by and large to give their support to Soviet foreign policy objectives. In the same way, the Soviet Union and the Communist bloc in general have continued to support the international communist movement, including the Eurocommunist parties, in innumerable practical ways. As Shapiro points out, there is no substantial evidence that there has been any disruption of the banking and commercial channels through which the Eurocommunist parties have traditionally been financed from Moscow. Since the mutual criticisms between the Soviet and Eurocommunist parties are mutually agreed upon between the leaders, there is no reason why the Soviets should wish to disrupt these channels. Nor, since all the 81 parties that signed the Manifesto of November 1960 are pursuing a common long-range policy, is there any need for Moscow to seek to attach strings to whatever financial or other aid it gives them. The anomalies in the adoption of Eurocommunism by Spanish communist leaders of the Stalinist generation, like Carrillo and Ibarruri, are striking. At the enlarged Spanish party plenum in 1977, the resolution endorsing Eurocommunism was proposed by none other than Ibarruri, who had spent much of her life in the Soviet Union, who had lost a son at Stalingrad, who had been eulogized in Novoi Vremya in May 1977, and who had earlier described Eurocommunism as nonsense. A few months after the plenum, she was back in Moscow for the 60th anniversary celebrations. The anomaly can be explained if it is remembered that she also was an active participant in the formulation of the long-range policy in 1957-60. The enthusiastic support given to Eurocommunism by the Romanian party is not a little curious, given the espousal of democratic liberties by the Eurocommunists and the repressive internal practices of the Romanian regime. No less odd, in conventional terms, was the apparently cordial meeting between Tito and Brezhnev on the eve of the European Communist Conference in East Berlin in June 1976 and the award of a Soviet decoration to Tito during a visit to Moscow in the following year. Despite his support of Eurocommunism, 7. The anomalies disappear if Eurocommunism is seen as a further strategic disinformation operation. Carrillo's declarations of independence of the Soviet Union are then seen to be as spurious as the Romanians and modeled on them. Both the Romanian and Yugoslav leaders have had an important role to play in supporting and coordinating the Eurocommunist movement. If accurate, the report on Romanian training of Spanish communists in urban guerrilla warfare is a further illustration of Romania's role in a coordinated bloc effort to assist the Eurocommunist parties. Continuing Eurocommunist contacts with the Soviets. The development of differences between the CPSU and the Eurocommunist parties has not, except in a few well-publicized instances, impeded the normal exchanges of visits between Soviet and Eurocommunist party delegations. Berlinger attended the 25th CPSU Congress in March 1976. He returned to Moscow for the 60th anniversary celebrations in November 1977 and was received in private audience by Brezhnev despite his commitment to pluralist democracy and the acceptance of continuing Italian membership in NATO. Although Carrillo absented himself from the 25th CPSU Congress, Ibarruri attended it. After the publication of Carrillo's book in April 1977, a CPSU delegation, led by the editor of Pravda, visited him, allegedly to work out some sort of truce. Carrillo was not afraid to return to Moscow for the 60th anniversary celebrations in November. The fact that he was present at the celebrations of the party he was purporting to criticize carries far more weight than his well-publicized complaints to Western journalists that he was not allowed to speak. Ibarruri spent a vacation in the Soviet Union in February 1979. Marche, the leader of the French party, stayed away from both the 25th CPSU Congress and the 60th anniversary celebrations in November 1977, but on both occasions his party was represented. And at the European Communist Conference in East Berlin in June 1976, Marche was present in person. In the course of 1977, the alliance between the French Communist and Socialist parties foundered as a result of communist intransigence. On October 2nd, Pravda published an article that was extravagant in its praise of Marche's policy. Thereafter, Marche increasingly withdrew from the Eurocommunist camp to the extent of aligning the French party with the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan at the end of 1979. The ease and impunity with which Marche has been able to lead the French party into and out of Eurocommunism is one of the more startling incongruities pointing to the contrived nature of the movement. Various explanations have been put forward. One is that the CPSU opposed the French party's electoral alliance with the socialists all along, and that when Marche, presumably acting independently, saw fit to break off the alliance, the Soviets were ready to welcome him back into the fold. Other explanations suggest that from late 1977 onward, the Soviets belatedly used either financial or blackmail pressure to bring Marche back to heel. Both these explanations are based on an outdated model of the relationship between the leaders of the CPSU and other communist parties. Both imply the existence of centrifugal forces in the movement that disappeared with the adoption of the common long-range policy in 1957-60. This provided a firm ideological foundation for a disciplined, coordinated Leninist revolutionary movement experienced enough to be able to reap the strategic and tactical advantages to be gained from a display of spurious differences. The new methodology sees the termination of the alliance with the socialists in France as a temporary measure decided on jointly between the Soviet and French communist leaders in the interests of communist strategy for Europe as a whole. The decision may well be related to the timing of the beginning of the final phase of long-range policy, when all the elements in communist strategy for Europe will be brought into play together. The present interpretation perhaps provides an explanation of the fact that, despite the breakup of the alliance, communist ministers were included in the government formed after the elections in 1981. The new interpretation of Eurocommunism. Since the adoption of the long-range policy in 1960, a series of regional communist conferences can be traced that dealt with communist strategy in Europe. Of particular importance were those in Prague and Moscow in October 1965 and in Karlovy Vary in 1967, the year before the Prague Spring. The Eurocommunist parties were represented at these conferences, which discussed the party's appeal to socialist, Catholic, and other Christian forces and the creation of a Europe free of military blocs. 8. In other words, the parties were seeking to broaden the basis of their united front tactics and at the same time were echoing the call for a Europe free of military blocs issued at the Bloc Summit Conference in Bucharest the year before. The carefully prepared Prague Spring of the following year, the deliberate association of the West European Communist parties with it, and their criticism of the Warsaw Pact intervention helped the European parties to shed the stigma that was attached to them as a result of the events in Czechoslovakia in 1948 and Hungary in 1956. It gave a powerful boost to their pursuit of United Front tactics. What was new in this situation was not the use of United Front tactics. The 1965 Prague Conference was held in celebration of the 30th anniversary of the adoption of United Front tactics by the Comintern. But the coordinated support given to them by Bloc strategic disinformation on Czechoslovak democratization. If the systematic disinformation about differences between the leaders of different communist parties is stripped away, the pattern of coordination between them in knitting together the various strands in their common strategy for Europe becomes clear. A series of preparatory conferences was held before the meeting of European communist parties in East Berlin in June 1976. The series included a preparatory session in Budapest in December 1974 and a conference at Tihany in May 1976. Devlin noted that after the Budapest meeting, a curtain of official secrecy descended over the proceedings. 9. But a detailed account of the Tihany meeting was eventually published 4 months later in Problems of Peace and Socialism. The account reflected very little discussion of Eurocommunist issues. The closing speech was delivered by Zaradov, who argued at length the strength which derives from unity and coordination of revolutionary action, a view with which the overwhelming majority of the parties represented agreed. 10. The old methodology assumes, and has assumed since 1960, that the differences between communist parties are real and that the talk of coordination between them is so much bluster intended to cover up the differences. The new methodology argues that the differences are spurious and are designed to cover up the coordination, which is real and which includes agreement to disagree for tactical and strategic purposes. As Tito and Kardelj put it, it is actions, not words, that count. Or, as Rumiantsev wrote in Problems of Peace and Socialism, statements should be evaluated in terms of class analysis. 11. The polemics between the Soviet and Eurocommunist leaders should therefore be read not as propaganda, but as disinformation intended to help the achievement of strategic or tactical objectives. The point can be illustrated by Berlinger's statement on television, which was broadcast 5 days before the elections in June 1976, that Italy should stay in the Atlantic Alliance. The pattern shows up clearly in the Spanish case also. The Eurocommunist summit meeting of French, Italian, and Spanish leaders was held in Madrid in March 1977. 1 month later, the decision was taken to legalize the Spanish party, and in the same month, Carrillo published Eurocomunismo y Estado. 2 months later, elections were held for the new Spanish Chamber of Deputies. If the Spaniards went further in their anti-Sovietism than the other Eurocommunist parties, this was because they had been deeply compromised by their treatment of socialists, anarchists, and others during the Spanish Civil War and needed urgently to refurbish their image if they were to acquire legal status, gain representation in Parliament, and successfully pursue an alliance with the socialists. Confirmation of the tactical nature of protestations by Eurocommunists of their conversion to democracy is to be found in a speech made in February 1976 by Dorofeev, a leading Soviet expert on Italian affairs. DORA 5 justified the Italian party's advocacy of certain specific freedoms on the grounds that it was intended solely as a means of winning over the Italian petty bourgeoisie. He explained that in reality the proletariat interpreted freedom quite differently from its temporary allies, and that consequently there was no need to be alarmed by changes of this kind in the programs of communist parties, which maintained a consistently revolutionary position. Point 12. Lenin advised the use of moderate language to avoid frightening the bourgeoisie. It was with such considerations in mind that Eurocommunist parties dropped the dictatorship of the proletariat, and in the case of the Spanish party, even the word Leninist from its title. In dropping the dictatorship of the proletariat, the Eurocommunist parties were following the example of the CPSU, which did so in 1961, also to improve its image. The possible adverse effects on international communism. Real disputes between the leaders of bloc and non-bloc parties would have a damaging effect on the international communist movement. Active collaboration between them in a disinformation operation based on false disputes serves to cement their working relationships. They can but enjoy together their success in fooling outside observers. Given that dissident movements in the communist bloc are under the control of the security services, neither the movements themselves nor Eurocommunist support for them represent any threat to the security of communist regimes. Potential adverse effects of Eurocommunist ideas on the membership of bloc parties that are not privy to disinformation operations are no doubt neutralized by secret party letters and briefings. As far as the East European general public is concerned, it can be protected from contamination by a combination of press censorship, intensified ideological work, and the dismissal of allegations of violations of human rights as Western bourgeois propaganda. In any case, given that the Eurocommunist dispute is a planned and controlled dispute, the appearance of adverse effects on either side of the Iron Curtain can be swiftly countered by damping down or dropping the dispute altogether. Senior members of the Eurocommunist parties no doubt appreciate the concrete tactical and strategic dividends to be derived from the exchange of criticism with the Soviet Union and realize that no sacrifice of communist principles is entailed. Nevertheless, the formation of a few pro-Moscow splinter groups might be held to be damaging to the Eurocommunist parties. Taking a long-term view, this is not necessarily so, and the arguments that follow apply equally to the formation of pro-Chinese splinter groups as a result of the Sino-Soviet split. In some cases, the formation of splinter groups may have been controlled. For example, the expulsion from the Spanish party in 1970 of a group of Stalinists who later formed the Spanish Communist Workers' Party under Enrique Lister might have been part of the forward planning for Eurocommunism. In other cases, splinter groups may have resulted from the spontaneous reaction of hardcore rank and file elements who were not initiated into high-level communist strategy. Such groups tend to contain the more militant strain of revolutionary. Even if they are involved in more or less violent disputes with one another or with the principal communist party, they remain under the influence of one or another member of the communist bloc, and not of any pro-Western or social democratic party. They provide a reserve of organized militants whose hour may come with a future shift in the communist line and the abandonment of parliamentary united front tactics. For Soviet leaders, untroubled as they are by electoral considerations, the temporary loss to Soviet international prestige entailed by Eurocommunist criticisms of their system is a small price to pay for the actual and potential strategic and tactical gains stemming from the improvement in the image and influence of the European Communist parties. Implications for Western propaganda. The identification of Eurocommunism as a disinformation operation has obvious implications for Western policies and propaganda concerned with communism. Ideas of exacerbating friction between the leaders of the bloc and Eurocommunist parties are self-defeating because there is no real friction. Western anti-communists who align themselves with Eurocommunists in support of East European dissidents are playing into their enemies' hands. They are falling for a communist provocation. The vulnerability of these alignments will be exposed when liberalization occurs in Eastern Europe in the final phase of long-range policy. Meanwhile, they confer greater respectability on Eurocommunists. Western anti-communist policies and propaganda can only recover their effectiveness if they are based on a correct understanding of the origins, nature, and objectives of the long-range policy and strategy and the disinformation techniques used in their implementation. Conclusion. By 1969, the bloc strategists had had a decade of experience in controlling and exploiting artificial disputes between the leaders of certain of the bloc parties. They had also had the experience of a controlled experiment in democratization in Czechoslovakia. They had seen how the West had been taken in by each of their disinformation operations in turn. They had seen how the image of West European communist parties had been improved by their association with the Dubček brand of communism and by their independent stand on Warsaw Pact intervention in Czechoslovakia in August 1968. Although the Dubček experiment had been brought to an end, there had been time for an assessment of its potential as a means of influencing Western attitudes to communism. The effect had been profound. It therefore made sense in the 1970s to explore the potential of artificial disputes with European communist parties to improve their future prospects. Such disputes, in the form of Eurocommunism, could be fitted into the pattern of the other disinformation operations. Eurocommunism could be supported by Romania and Yugoslavia, the independent communist states, and attacked both by the Soviets and Chinese. Mutual criticisms between the Soviets and Eurocommunists would help to dispel fears of the introduction of a Soviet system into Western Europe and confirm the sincerity of the Eurocommunist conversion to democratic principles. Chinese accusations that Eurocommunists were falling under social democratic influence could further the illusion that this was so. With their credentials thus improved, the Eurocommunist parties would stand to gain new allies among the working classes, the social democrats, the petty bourgeoisie, the intelligentsia, the churches, and the armed forces, and thus be able to play a more influential role in overall communist strategy in Europe. Like Czechoslovak democratization, Eurocommunism should be viewed as an experiment and rehearsal for the final phase of policy. Its potential has not yet been fully realized. Objectives of Eurocommunism: the extension of already proven disinformation techniques into Western Europe to suggest the evolution of the Eurocommunist parties into liberalized, independent, responsible national parties was intended to conceal the coordination between the Eurocommunist parties and the bloc in the pursuit of a common strategy for Europe, suggest further disintegration in the international communist movement, and therefore a diminution in its threat to the non-communist world, improve the capacity of the Eurocommunist parties to achieve influence and power legally through united front tactics, prepare the ground, in coordination with bloc policy in general, for an eventual liberalization in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and a major drive to promote the dissolution of NATO and the Warsaw Pact and the withdrawal of the American military presence from a neutral, socialist Europe.